I'm going to give an overview of the topic. It's especially important, actually. There were a couple of the invited speakers who asked me what adaptive movement was. So these organisms, Cape buffalo, aren't moving at the moment, but they probably will soon. And their movement is going to influence the amount of vegetation in different places. It's going to have repercussions for the predator populations that eat both them and other herbivores in the Serengeti. And there's very little about the ecosystem that they live in that is in not some way influenced either by their own movements or movements of other animals. So space in general and movement are important questions in almost every area of ecology and evolution. So it's been realized for quite some time that if you have limited movement and localized interactions and spatial heterogeneity, which applies to almost any organism in any system outside of the lab that you might care to look at, ecological and evolutionary processes are likely to differ in some way from what they would be in a homogeneous or well-mixed system. So if you want to get a good description of a global system, then it may be important to consider these things. And like most things in biology, we expect movement to be adaptive. So we want to know how that influences global and local functional forms of interaction. Movement has a long history in theoretical biology, but I think it's fair to say that a lot of what we know about movement is based on what I'm calling here classical movement, which is random in the sense that distances and directions and probabilities of movement are independent of both individual condition and environmental condition. That tradition in theoretical biology arose because that's the simplest kind of model. And after people did that for a while, there was a tradition. So because other people had assumed this, the tradition just carried on. But these assumptions about movement conflict with the most basic biological facts that we know about movement, and even plants, seeds, can influence their direction and distance of movement. So movement is expected to have some adaptive aspects. So our first invited speaker tomorrow, a couple of years ago, wrote this first statement, which is basically that there's been very little work, surprisingly little, on models with adaptive movement. And the second speaker, who was one of a number of Europeans we didn't invite because it would have been expensive, so that's another motivation for having another meeting, points out that there are very good theoretical reasons to believe that random movement is the exception and maybe may not happen at all. So it would be a good idea to know more about conditional or adapted movement. And if you haven't read it yet, there was a good review of this a few years ago by Diane Bowler and Tim Benton, I think in Biological Reviews. And they pointed out that ecology and evolution both influenced the nature of adaptive dispersal. And the one thing that they did not talk very much about was interactions between species. So interactions between species are community ecology, and that influences actually more than just the three boxes I've indicated. And you could draw complicated loop diagrams for the community effects on each one of those boxes. So we are dealing with a fairly complicated territory, and that's part of the reason why there probably hasn't been very much work on it. But there are very few questions that are important to ecologists or evolutionary biologists that are not influenced by adaptive movement. And this list gives just a few of those. So basic things like how ecosystems will respond to global perturbations and what species diversity we can expect and how we can expect it to change are all influenced by whether movement is adaptive or not. If you're interested in the topic, you've probably run across one of many books. These are just two of, I think, about a dozen that have come out in the last decade dealing with dispersal by Peter Turchin and a collection of chapters edited by Clobert and others. But if you look at these and most other books, there's relatively little dealing with adaptive movement. And you have to look for a few paragraphs and a few chapters to find anything. So when I talk about movement, I mean a vast variety of different things. Movement is studied under many different names. So I'm not dealing just with dispersal of propagules like seeds or animals that move once in their lifetime. I'm also dealing with topics in foraging theory where animals move around to find where the best source of food is or where they switch habitats to get more food, or anti-predator behavior is often moving to an area that has fewer predators or more hiding places. So all of these things are movement. And movement has also been studied using many different mathematical frameworks. And one of the organizing principles for this workshop was to get together a number of different people who had used different approaches because ideally different approaches applied to the same question should give you similar answers, but there has been this tendency, since you need to make different simplifying assumptions to get analytical results using different techniques, for different people using different approaches to often get different answers regarding the same question. So that's one of the things we'd like to iron out or find out more about during the course of the workshop. As I mentioned when I was talking about Bowler and Benton, movement is usually studied in the context of a single species. So when you find the relatively few articles on adaptive movement, most of them assume density-dependent growth of a single species. But if you look at the ecological literature in general or textbooks, there's a lot more about communities and interactions between species. And it's actually been recognized that that's important for movement as early as Andy See's work on behavioral response races of predators and prey. That was back in the early 80s. And Michael Rosenzweig's not very well-known work from the 90s, and a growing body of work that you'll be hearing more about over the course of the next few days. So that's what I'm talking about with movement. What is it that I mean by adaptive? That's a harder question, and in general, it's movement that increases fitness relative to no movement or to non-adaptive movement. But that leads to this thorny question of what is fitness. And fitness is different depending on the time scale that you look at. And if you look at longer time scales, you have to consider the cost of movement. If you're looking at adaptation in any context, you have to know what strategies are available what constraints are on those strategies, which includes the constraint of what information is available to the animal that's going to move about what conditions are like where it is now and what conditions are like elsewhere. So there is no very simple answer to what makes movement adaptive. So if you have movement with random dispersal and one event per lifetime, then I can illustrate some of these complications, even though that's one of the simpler forms of movement. So if we assume that there's what's known as implicit space, that when an animal leaves a given patch, it can go to any other patch equally easily, and all the patches are the same, so it's a homogeneous environment in that sense, then there's still a question of should you disperse or not disperse? And the things, the biological processes that affect that include inbreeding, competition with kin, local adaptation, the amount of spatial and temporal heterogeneity, and costs of movement, any environmental biases such as currents or wind. So most populations consist of organisms that differ from each other in sex, age, size, condition, other factors. So there are a lot of things that go into finding out what form adaptive movement has, even if you're just calculating probabilities of moving out of a patch to some randomly chosen other patch. And if we have explicit space and more environmental heterogeneity, there are more choices. So describing the movement strategy completely becomes more complicated. So it's complicated enough, even with a single species model. There's a bunch of work by Alan Hastings, Vincent Jansen, and other people looking at simple two-patch models with the simplest kind of interaction you can have, just a predator-prey system in each patch. And for those systems, even if the patches are identical, if you have cycling populations, the dynamics of the system can be very complex. You can have at very low movement rates, the two patches tend to synchronize with each other. At slightly higher movement rates between these two patches, you get anti-synchronized cycles, so they're 180 degrees out of phase. And with very high movement rates, you can get synchronization again. You can also get the cycles changing to stability with almost no individuals in one of the predators in one of the two patches and a lot in the other. You can also get chaotic dynamics. So when you add adaptive considerations to that, one of the first things to ask is, if you have that kind of system, what should the probability of moving be, even if it's just a fixed probability of moving independent of what's actually happening in your patch? So that's been considered by some of the people here and others. And it also turns out to be very complicated. So this is a couple of graphs from that paper by Michael Dobley and Graham Ruxton. So they studied, again, a two-patch system, just density-dependent growth in this case. But it was density-dependent growth that resulted in cyclic dynamics. And when they allowed different dispersal strategies to compete with each other, they got cycles, shown by the top graph. I guess I have a pointer here. So these are different dispersal rates, so the dots represent individuals having these rates, and we have a very long time span here. And the reason you get cycles is that dispersal is costly. So what's happening is dispersal rate is going up, and that eventually synchronizes the population, so there's no fitness difference between the patches because they're both going up and down in density in the exact same way. So if there's no difference, there's no point in having costly movement to the other patch. So then the dispersal rate evolves down. But once you get to a low enough dispersal rate, the patches desynchronize and you reverse the direction of movement. So you get these continual cycles. So that's one of the simplest aspects of dispersal. There's also been some work on adaptive aspects of movement that occur within a lifespan, and I've done some of that. So in the little remaining time that I have, I'm going to just briefly go over some of that. And a lot of that's related to this concept of the ideal free distribution. The first time I talked about work on movement, I Googled ideal free distribution, and this was the first hit. I'm happy to report that now it's the second in the list. And as far as I know, this band from Lexington, Kentucky is still together, but I still haven't listened to their stuff. But they did name their band explicitly after the biological concept, and now the first hit is the Wikipedia definition of ideal free distribution, which is based on this work by Fretwell and Lucas from 1970, published in a journal that still exists, but if you published in it today, regardless of what it was you published, no one would look at it. So they were lucky to have done this work quite a while ago, and they pointed out that this was a distribution with equivalent individuals having equal fitness in all occupied patches, and they would have greater fitness than they would have in a currently unoccupied patch. They also have this other process-based definition, the distribution achieved when individuals have perfect information and no constraints on movement, which they argued would lead to this, but that really wasn't demonstrated. And in fact, they did point out that that wasn't necessarily true. So these are figures from their paper. This one is reproduced in a lot of textbooks, and it shows fitness as a function of population size in three habitats that differ in quality. So if population size of the organisms using those habitats is low, they'll all go to the best habitat. Things get worse because it gets crowded, and then at some point the quality, because of crowding, is as the same as it would be in the second best habitat. So then both of these get filled at a rate that preserves their equality, and the third habitat starts getting filled when it's when population is high enough that you pass this threshold. So that's the basic logic, but they also have this thing that I'm calling Fretwell's forgotten figure, because almost no one knows about it, and I didn't know about it until a couple of years ago, but many organisms are thought to have a Lee effect, where the fitness actually goes up as population size goes from zero to a relatively small number of individuals. So here, this habitat is the better one, so it starts getting filled first and its fitness actually goes up. Then it eventually becomes too crowded. And at this density, the fitness is the same as the individuals might achieve in the other habitat. But of course, if one individual left at this point, it would be experiencing a very low density in the other habitat. So no individuals are likely to leave till density gets up here. And then at that point, as they start filling this habitat, its fitness actually goes up rapidly. So there should be a very rapid transition to the other habitat and then maybe back. And they said there may be erratic changes in distribution, but they actually didn't do any analysis. In fact, they threw out the whole idea as being unlikely that allele effects were very rare. That was before conservation biology was very big, so most people would have a different view of the frequency of allele effects now. And we still don't know in many circumstances what would happen given an allele effect. So it should have been clear that the movement rule may determine whether an ideal free distribution is achieved or not, even if movement is free and all individuals have knowledge of what conditions are everywhere else. So there have been a lot of experimental studies that went out into the field, looked at whether you got ideal free distributions, and depending on who you read, either a lot or most cases do not have ideal free distributions. So the there are two contexts that seem likely to cause that. First, everything's changing, so organisms may not be able to keep up with the change rate of the environment and achieve an ideal free distribution. And it could be that interacting species are changing at the same time, even if the environment isn't, and they could cause the change in conditions that other species can't keep up with. So I started working on this whole set of questions of adaptive movement when I got interested in this system of stream insects that Bobby Pekarsky has worked on for many decades. So this is a system where the quality of the patches can change very rapidly because the algae that form the basis of the food chain can go from zero to their maximum density where they start to fall off the rocks in about a week. And you have mayflies eating that algae, and they have a lifespan of many weeks. And you have environmental change happening on a rapid time scale because summers are short in the mountains where these organisms have been studied, and flow and illumination change. So we have this basic food web where the herbivorous mayflies are moving, and they move based on algae on the rocks. Their movements are influenced by brook trout and by stoneflies. So they try to move away from areas where those predators are common. But they also, with trout, they try to reduce movement during the day. So my first, one of my first papers on this was a characterization of this system with a simple two-patch model with fixed numbers of consumers and eating resources, algae, in two patches. And those patches had different flow or illumination that varied, and I assumed it varied in an anti-synchronized way, so one patch was getting better when the other was getting worse. And the mayflies distributed themselves by using this function to move towards the patch that had more food at the given moment. There was no population dynamics of the mayflies. The trout were only influencing this movement rate parameter. And this surprisingly simple model gave surprising dynamics. You often had alternative possible dynamics depending on the starting densities of the mayfly. And you had different and surprising outcomes depending on this rate constant, which influenced how fast the mayflies moved in response to changes in condition an amount of algae. So either very slow movement or very fast movement resulted in both relatively low mean algal densities and relatively low differences between the two patches in their algal density at a given point of time averaged over time. But intermediate movement rates, for one thing, could give you alternative attractors and also frequently gave you very large differences between the patches and fairly large population sizes. So these are movement rates that allow the algae to grow up to a fairly large population size, thereby being very productive, and that allowed a large difference between patches because the accuracy of the consumer choice was based on the absolute difference between patches. But that wasn't true when movement was basically rare and random because there were always individuals eating the algae in all the patches. So this is just another graph from that. So I went on from that to look at a variety of other two-patch systems, maintaining this focus on the simplest systems. So this was work that was inspired by Ross Cressman, and he had worked with Vlastimil Krivan and Josef Garay. And we later did some work, and it was work on two competing species occupying two patches. And here we had a slightly different movement function with movement based on what are known as replicator dynamics. But it's basically a case where, again, the proportion of the individuals of one species or the other in patch one went up if the fitness in patch one, which is this expression, was greater than the fitness in patch two. And it had usually been assumed that in a competitive system, this would result in something like an ideal free distribution with equal fitness for all individuals within each species. But it turns out that for at least some perhaps weird sets of parameters, that's not what happens when individuals move towards the patch that has a higher fitness according to those replicator dynamics. So this gives you dynamics of both population sizes starting in a system where each species is at its carrying capacity in its better patch, which is different for the two species. And this shows you the proportion of individuals of each species in patch number one. So species one prefers patch one, species two prefers patch two, and eventually you get these cycles, very large amplitude cycles, with the species moving back and forth in an anti-synchronized way between the two patches. So different movement rules give you a number of different options. You may get these anti-synchronized cycles, or this is a case with fairly accurate discrimination between patches but not a very high movement rate. You can get a stable outcome that's different from either of the outcomes that Ross got in that original model. So that brings up the question, since you can get different outcomes, how should we model adaptive movement? To what extent should we, since we don't know much about it, just assume very simple rules of thumb as what was assumed in this paper with the unpronounceable author's name, and which was predators are going to move towards areas of prey density, so they're less likely to move away from an area with high density, and they're more likely to move away from an area with predator density, and we assume some simple functions for that. How much do abiotic as well as biotic conditions affect movement? How do you integrate those two? And one thing we'd like to know is how common that outcome that I showed you for the competition model actually is. How often do different movement rules give you different predictions? So the movement rule that you get can depend on whether there are constraints on movement, so whether movement can only happen in a very narrow time window or can happen over a fairly prolonged period. This was something I looked at again in a two-patch parasitoid host model with a prey, the parasitoid moving adaptively to try to achieve an ideal free distribution. And depending on which constraint you used, there were different possible ways of defining an ideal free distribution. So under one condition, the parasitoids could keep laying eggs on their hosts throughout the season. In another, they only had a brief window, so they had to choose a patch before the hosts had actually all been parasitized. So those gave different outcomes. So one of them never gave you a stable equilibrium, whereas the other did, but they were both less stable than a parasitoid that just moved randomly or did not move between patches. So another set of questions that we're going to look at is how evolution is affected by adaptive movement of interacting species. And again, I'll just briefly mention some of my work on this, which was an elaboration of earlier work by Martijn Ahas. And that was looking at movement of generalist consumers between patches where there were different prey or host species. That involves a trade-off, so individuals can try to exploit both hosts, and in doing so, they may do better or worse than the specialists. So they have some trait that determines how good they are morphologically at eating prey one versus prey two, or being a generalist. So this is a fitness of an organism in an environment with equal abundances of the two prey. And one possibility is that a generalist does better than a specialist. It can eat both at a reduced rate, which means it gets more food. But if it's also able to select habitats that only contain one of those prey, that alters the fitness surface from this to this, because a specialist now can go wherever its prey is abundant and can achieve much greater fitness, whereas a generalist can't do any better by choosing the patch with prey one or prey two. So what this does is increase disruptive selection on the morphological trait, and that increase occurs no matter what the original shape of the trade-off between being good at resource one or resource two is. So again, I'm not going to go into any details, but if you look at almost any question that's been examined in the context of random movement or classical movement, and think about how adaptive movement would affect it, you'll find that there are undiscovered or at least unappreciated things. So Simon Levin's work was one of the first papers that pointed out that if you had a two-patch system, you could have coexistence of very strong competitors that wouldn't coexist in a single patch. The outcome that allowed coexistence was one competitor became abundant in one patch and therefore excluded a second, and this the reverse happened in the other patch. So depending on initial densities in the two patches, you may or may not get coexistence. In fact, if you allow adaptive rather than random movement, it makes it much more likely that you will get coexistence in this kind of a system. And as far as I know, the details of that haven't been worked out, nor has this question that I'll skip over, maybe Bob will talk about it, and there are a range of questions that have been looked at in between when Yuan and I first wrote the proposal for this workshop. This is just one of them that points out that evolution of movement rates can have a big effect on the spread of invasive species during the invasion process. And we're going to hear a lot about specific systems or specific types of movement. So I think we'll hear a lot of new work over the course of the next few days. And I'm going to end slightly over time, but I'll be keeping time after this. So,